To begin our series looking at Idaho's fraught relationship with white supremacy, we take a snapshot of the North, where the legacy of hate was most pronounced. The swastika flags are gone, and the Aryan Nations compound in Hayden Lake was razed to the ground in 2001. The stain brought to the region by neo-Nazis continues to blight its reputation, but people in the panhandle say the area welcomes diversity and has moved forward. Still, as Maculum discovered on a recent trip to the North, the past continues to haunt the present.
In the summer of 1999, the nation's attention turned to North Idaho to watch a bizarre neo-Nazi spectacle, not unlike the recent torchlit rally in Charlottesville, Virginia.
I have no guilt whatsoever about being a white man and white and proud. That's why they hate me so much.
Pastor Richard Butler presides over the Aryan Nations World Congress. The media is here because he and fellow white supremacists planned a march on downtown Coeur d'Alene.
That clip, courtesy of KTVB, illustrates the boldness of the Aryan Nations at the height of their visibility. Throughout the 1980s and 90s, the group targeted minorities and inspired splinter groups that killed people, robbed banks, and bombed Coeur d'Alene. However, a year after that 1999 parade along Sherman Avenue in the city's downtown, the group was brought to its knees by a lawsuit that bankrupted it, took away the vast compound, and saw the group break off into other factions on the East Coast. Just off Highway 95, in the north part of Coeur d'Alene, across from the mall, there's a shopping center. Christina Hammond is walking out of one of the stores with her friends. Hammond is 25, a nurse, and from the area. She was a child when the Aryan Nations was at its peak and subsequently fell.
I feel like it's changed. I've watched it change throughout the years, where less and less people were racist and just became comfortable. You look around and there are African Americans around here and you don't see people looking at them suspiciously. It's just people walking down the street.
While the overt Butler-era demonstrations may be in the past, California transplant Cynthia Del Monte, who's called Coeur d'Alene home for 5 years, thinks racist tensions still exist.
I would say it's not as prevalent, but it's still here.
Although Del Monte hadn't heard of North Idaho's reputation for white supremacy before she arrived, she thinks it's known for other things.
That's more prevalent here, the conservative values and the Christian values.
But racism and religion in the region have often gone hand in hand. Butler adopted Christian identity theology and led a congregation in Hayden Lake. And just north of there, in Sandpoint, the Southern Poverty Law Center identifies a church with ties to the Aryan Nations as a designated hate group. Pastor Dave Barley leads America's Promise Ministries. He ignored multiple requests for an interview, but his sermons are posted online.
We're not going to hide it. Oh, well, we love you, and just come on in and blend with us. We don't want to offend you, so we're not going to teach anything about God's law says about race mixing. No, we are going to teach that. And you're going to understand black family and white family and Chinese family, whoever you are out there, that will not be tolerated in this church.
On a drive past his church on a recent Sunday, just 7 cars were scattered throughout the parking lot during a service. A few minutes away from America's Promise Ministries, in the heart of Sandpoint, is Connie's Cafe. Coffee cups are never left empty, the blueberry pancakes are delicious, and manager Bethany Vernon is kept informed of what's going on around town from her regulars. On this morning, she's talking about flyers being left on cars in the small lakeside town.
They're really hateful, and they're not put together very well, and they're very facetious and deceitful.
A range of flyers have been left on cars and buildings around Sandpoint under cover of darkness, targeting the city's mayor, Jews, and blacks. In bold red letters, one declares, "Negroes out of Sandpoint."
Yeah, we're outraged by it. It's ridiculous. I think they need to find out who it is. You know, I mean, it's freedom of speech, of course, but it should be stopped. You know, I don't know whether criminally or how they would actually stop it, but it needs to be stopped.
Vernon says the overt racism of a generation ago has faded.
However, with the recent election and the huge divide in the country, I think maybe it's kind of coming back a little bit.
News of the flyers not only spread by word of mouth, but also digitally, according to Tim Wilson, the manager of a small Sandpoint welding shop.
I got a text message from a friend with a flyer the other day, and I assumed it was a photo of a flyer that had been handed out 50, 100 years ago. I was just disgusted by it. I couldn't really believe that it happened in today's day and age.
Whether Sandpoint or Coeur d'Alene, the people of both areas say North Idaho isn't the bastion of racism it once was. They blame a small fringe for continuing to stir the pot and push an agenda of hate. Standing back in the parking lot of the shopping center in Coeur d'Alene, Cynthia Del Monte, the California transplant, hits on a question nobody can or wants to answer.
I don't know. Everyone's really nice up here, but I wonder how much of that is because I am a middle-aged white woman.
Swastika-draped cars and compounds staffed by armed guards are close to 20 years in North Idaho's past. But for Del Monte, the question of what's behind closed doors lingers. For KBSX News, I'm Matt Gillum reporting from Coeur d'Alene.
In February, the City Council in Charlottesville, Virginia, voted to remove a statue of Robert E. Lee from a park, which at the time had the same name. And although Idaho doesn't have a monument dedicated to Lee, the debate over Confederate symbols is not confined to southern states. Frankie Barnhill has more in the second part of our series, Legacy of Hate.
It turns out there's a whole mobile home park in Boise that's named after the Civil War.
In a quarter mile, turn left onto Confederate Lane.
After a few more turns on similarly antebellum named streets, I find the house I'm looking for.
My name is Alan Waldie, and we are presently at the Flag Store of Idaho.
Waldie runs his business out of his home office, an orderly room with boxes of neatly stacked flags on shelves that go up to the ceiling. He takes out a pair of scissors and gingerly cuts the edge of the plastic cover to a flag at his desk.
Yeah, let me get this flag out for you. Okay. This is a 2x3 Confederate battle.
This is the one under the controversy.
Waldie sells a handful of Confederate flags a year, about the same as any other flag in his store. But unlike other products, the choice to sell them isn't automatic.
I did have to kind of think about it a little bit because of the Confederate battle flag being labeled racist.
But the businessman didn't agree with this label, and so he decided to keep the flag in his inventory. Waldie has to special order them through a company in Georgia because the national flag companies he usually buys from don't stock the Confederate symbol anymore. Waldie's neighborhood isn't the only place in Idaho with a southern name. In 1863, President Lincoln established the Idaho Territory. The huge swath of land encompassed what is now Montana, Idaho, and most of Wyoming. At the same time, thousands of miners, many of them Confederate veterans or sympathizers, came to the Boise Basin after gold was struck near Idaho City.
Ever since that day, Idaho has been a northern satellite for the South.
That's Boise State History Professor Todd Shallett. He says places like Atlanta, Grayback Gulch, and Stanley get their name from Confederate history. There's even a few spots named Dixie and a Robert E. Lee campground. Shallett says many of the Confederate sympathizers who came to Idaho were seeking a better life far from the horrors of the Civil War. But just because Richmond was thousands of miles away didn't mean their dreams of a white-dominant, small-government, agricultural haven couldn't come true.
And so it was that Lincoln and the Union realized that the war was really about who was going to control the West. So what they did is they took action.
Lincoln sent Union soldiers to a new post at Fort Boise to prevent a new South from forming, just one day after the Battle of Gettysburg ended. For Nate Piles, Civil War history is deeply personal. Piles is the chaplain of the Idaho chapter of the Sons of Confederate Veterans and calls it a heritage group. Piles has ancestors who fought and died for both the Union and the Confederacy. He's pored over his family history his whole life, which inspired him to get involved with the group. He says being a member of the Sons of Confederate Veterans is complicated today.
We don't want to be labeled something we're not, you know? We abhor, you know, racism and white supremacism and all that rubbish.
Piles doesn't want monuments to be removed, and he acknowledges that the Confederate flag has been used by racists throughout the years, as it was in Charlottesville. But he insists he and his group have nothing to do with that image.
It pisses me off. I mean, it really does. I think it's disgusting that people hijack the Confederate flag for, you know, white racism.
But to Vince Hutchings, honoring his Confederate heritage is not as innocuous as Piles may think.
Does that make them bad people? No, it does not. I am being emphatic here. It does not make them bad people. But to say that, well, because it is about heritage, it is necessarily not about race. I am saying that is wrong.
Hutchings is a political science professor at the University of Michigan. He says you can't have a conversation about Confederate flags or monuments without bearing in mind one thing.
It is worth noting, of course, that the Confederacy was designed to preserve and to expand slavery. That was the whole point of the war.
In downtown Boise, Philip Thompson flips on the lights of the Idaho Black History Museum, where he's the executive director. After the violent rally in Charlottesville, the museum hosted an event and hundreds of people came, most of them white. Thompson says they had a lot of questions.
What do we do now? How do we fix this? What is the role we can play?
Thompson, who was born and raised in Idaho, says the reaction to remove Confederate monuments and flags around the country is understandable. But he says as a black man in Idaho, he takes a slightly different approach.
Somebody's saying they want to celebrate their Confederate history. I can't automatically assume that that means, oh, they want to celebrate the institution of slavery.
One time, he had to inform an acquaintance who had a Confederate sticker on his phone about the history of the symbol.
And he identified it more in a Western Idaho cowboy, you know, Ford truck, etc., libertarian kind of small government disposition. And he wasn't even aware of the full meaning of the Stars and Bars of the South because we're from up here and he's 22 years old.
Thompson admits if he lived in the South, his reaction might be different. But he says people still need to be sensitive when they fly the battle flag because it can be an aggressive gesture. He notes there needs to be ongoing conversation between both sides. The Idahoan says it's hard to find much hope when he looks at the national conversation around race these days, but that we've got to keep trying. For KBSX News, I'm Frankie Barnhill.
Earlier in our Legacy of Hate series, we took you to North Idaho to look at the history of the Aryan Nations and the effects that still ripple through that community. The compound made North Idaho infamous, but statistics show that year after year, it's Boise that has topped the list for the number of hate crimes reported. Samantha Wright found that Southern Idaho, too, has an unfavorable history that persists into the present.
It was a hot morning this July when Salam Bunyan walked up to Goodness Land on Overland Road in Boise to find a crowd of people gathered outside his restaurant.
And I see many police department outside, and I told him, hi guys, I'm the owner of this place, what's going on?
Someone had drawn a swastika along with anti-refugee messages in chalk on the sidewalk outside his front door.
When I see him, actually I'm scared for the first time. I'm sad because that's happening in Boise. But Boise, that's my home. I'm sad because I see that's in my home.
Boise has been home to Bunyan, his wife, and their kids since 2008 when they fled violence in Iraq. He says he's always felt safe here until now. The vandalism was just one of several acts of hate in Boise this year. Across town at the Anne Frank Memorial, workers begin sawing off the tops of large stone tablets, which are etched with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. They're being replaced after several passages were destroyed in May after vandals spray-painted hate signs and words onto the stone.
The tagging was racist in nature, and it was strategically placed right where it talks about us all being members of the same human family.
That's Dan Prinzing, the executive director of the Wasmus Center for Human Rights, which built and houses the memorial. Prinzing wonders how something like this could happen in Boise.
Maybe we've become complacent. Maybe we thought the progress that we were seeing was going to carry us.
That progress is often considered to be the destruction of the Aryan Nations compound in North Idaho in 2001. But hate hasn't been unique to the northern part of the state, despite conventional wisdom from those in the south. On a per capita basis, Coeur d'Alene ranked first among reported hate crimes since 1991, when records started being kept by the Idaho State Police. But Boise topped the list in number of hate crimes reported more than 65% of the time in year-by-year data, and there were only 3 years when Boise wasn't among the top three. That doesn't surprise Jill Gill, professor of history at Boise State University. She says there are plenty of historical instances of hate in southern Idaho, like a Ku Klux Klan parade in 1923.
With floats and pyrotechnics and cross burnings and initiations that happened down in the fairgrounds here, it caused such a crowd that there were traffic jams for people that came out to watch this thing.
Racism has continued throughout Boise's history. Gill says through the mid-20th century, the community feared a new African-American population coming to town, keeping them confined to River Street, Boise's segregated neighborhood. Black families who moved out of River Street were met with cross burnings on their lawns and death threats up to 1968, when the Fair Housing Act made it illegal to keep minorities in their own neighborhoods. Gill says it's dangerous that the Aryan Nations got most of the press because for a lot of Idaho, that became the face of racism instead of its more subtle forms.
We don't tend to look at the fact that housing and job discrimination were integral to Idaho's history just as much as it was in other places around the country.
In the last 6 years, Boise has topped the list for the number of hate crimes 5 times. And this year, it's well on its way to leading again with a series of events that appear to be motivated by hate against immigrants, the LGBTQ community, and Jewish people at the Anne Frank Memorial. Boise police declared the tagging there a hate crime, and no one has been arrested. BPD Detective Josiah Ransom is with the Violent Crimes Unit, which investigates hate crimes. He says there are special procedures when this type of crime happens, and there's a massive response by the city.
There's a lot of effort to put into that because we don't tolerate that, and we don't want that to be what our city is known for.
He says a lot of manpower has gone into the memorial case, from the investigation to extra patrols to stop future vandalism. He says this year's crimes are disgusting, but don't reflect the city as a whole.
3 incidents in our city of our size does not make us a racist city or anything like that. The vast majority of our citizens do not tolerate that, do not appreciate that mentality, and are going to do whatever they can to stomp it out.
And you can see the community response at the Anne Frank Memorial, where flowers and signs appeared the week after the vandalism. Volunteers asked to stand vigil at night to protect the site. And so far, $67,000 has been raised to put in new tablets to replace the ones that were damaged. People also started writing words of support and drawing hearts and peace signs on the sidewalk outside Goodness Land Restaurant. The idea grew, and now Salam Bunyan leaves a basket of chalk outside his door. Every night when he locks up, he stops and takes a picture with his phone of the new words of hope, not hate, that have appeared during the day while he's been cooking.
That's the people in Boise. Always great, always help, always support anyone coming. Doesn't matter what color, what religion, what language. The people nice, support anyone he wants to start a new life.
Bunyan says he and his customers are fighting the hate that's kept Boise one of, if not the top city of hate in Idaho over the past 2.5 decades, with words and symbols of love drawn every day in chalk on the sidewalk. For KBSX News, I'm Samantha Wright.
Controversial speakers at college campuses across the country have sparked protests in recent months, some of which have turned violent. Some are now calling on universities and even government to outlaw what they view as hate speech, even though it's a constitutional right. In the final part of our series, Legacy of Hate, James Dawson speaks with University of Idaho law professor Shakira Sanders about whether this is a new phenomenon and how these conflicts might be resolved.
Certainly, we're in a heightened, more sensitive area right after the election or about a year out from the election. But issues surrounding how to deal with hate speech, speakers on college campuses and universities, I think these issues have always occurred. We're just at a heightened time.
But historically, those who have identified as liberals have really strongly advocated for free speech, especially in the mid-1960s. So where has this shift kind of occurred?
Well, I think you see a few things that are happening. One, universities are making a decision that it just may be too dangerous for some speakers to come out. And there may be a concern that they are unable to maintain discipline and order on their campus. And that's certainly a very compelling interest for them. And their argument would be that it's so compelling that we would have to watch who we invite to our campus, maybe cancel an event if the violence has gotten pretty heightened before the person even comes out.
But do you think at all that colleges who do choose to cancel these events, whether or not they say the reason was because they want to maintain safety on campus, do you think that that's contributing to what some might view as a problem, where they are, in some people's minds, limiting free speech?
Well, it could be a chicken and egg situation, right? If you invite a speaker who some find are controversial, right? And that leads to protests, and those protests lead to violence before the person gets there. Then as a college, you have to think about the type of liabilities you could have if people get hurt, the expenses that could occur if property is destroyed. And so it becomes maybe more of a cost-benefit analysis. On the other hand, I think the fact that the college was willing to invite the person out does show that there's a certain level of acceptance from the administrative point of view. But at some point, the college's duties are multifaceted.
An op-ed in the Los Angeles Times by Laura Beth Nelson, who's the head of legal studies at Northwestern University. She's arguing that hate speech should be regulated since disadvantaged minorities are really the ones taking the brunt of the hit here. Do you think that that's a fair argument?
I don't think that that is a fair argument under the First Amendment. To the extent that the court has spoken on hate speech and lewd speech and all types of speech, the court has made very clear that hate speech is protected speech. Now, can states or cities or localities pass laws that say, hey, you can't threaten people, right? Or, hey, you can't create a hostile environment for a coworker. Now, those are ways in which we regulate speech. But to say one whole category of speech that's derogatory is unprotected, I think would lead to many openings of doors that we probably don't want to open.
Some who are pushing for further restrictions say letting hate speech continue as it is really fosters an environment that hate speech turns into violent mm-hmm. action. How do you prevent that or at least try to stamp that down?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think violent action is what leads to violent action, not speech. Speech can agitate. But when you engage in violent action, we are all making the choice to engage in that action. And to be clear, hate speech has played a role throughout history in oppressing people and maintaining oppression, demeaning people. That's a history that we need to continue to confront. And so to some degree, I think a lot of the agitation is just that struggle, right? That uniquely American struggle of race in our society, race in the way it permeates our society. And I just think we need to keep talking about it, keep working towards it, hopefully less violence surrounding it. But you know, violence has always been part of our social movement past as well. We can't remove what actually has worked, which is talking to each other, speaking to each other, exercising our First Amendment rights in a way that we reach a better understanding.